everyone, and welcome to episode 80 of the Psych Files, in which I'm going to talk to Dr. Martha Strauss about her book, No Talk Therapy. I don't spend a whole lot of episodes of the Psych Files on therapy, but like most students coming out of bachelor's degree in psychology, I was interested in going the traditional route, and that is to become a therapist. Some of the first jobs that I got in psychology were in the area of counseling, and for a time I worked at a halfway house with adults who were released from psychiatric hospitals, and they were making their way back into the world. And I was supervised by a very experienced therapist, a person with whom I have a great deal of respect. She taught me a lot, and she was trained out of the psychoanalytic tradition. I think in particular her interest was in a woman named Melanie Klein. But at any rate, she impressed upon me one very important thing. She sort of reminded me that people who go into the helping professions obviously want to help. And it is that very desire to help that we have to be careful about. Because you have to think about whatever it is you're doing, whatever help you're giving, be it in the form of what you say in a therapy session, medication you might recommend or prescribe, hospitalization, whatever route you go in giving a patient help, is that help motivated out of what the patient needs or out of your desire to help? What lies behind our desire to help? And that's what drew me a bit to No Talk Therapy, because I have seen a lot of therapists who say things, as I'll mention in this interview, that I think are really more about them feeling that they need to help rather than truly understanding where the client is coming from and what the need is that the client needs to express. So therapy can turn into a kind of lecture. That's how it's often portrayed on television and in the movies. You see therapy portrayed as a kind of back and forth, and the therapist educating the client as to how they should feel. That is a naive perspective on what psychotherapy is, but we have to understand that the scenes that we see on television were probably written by people who have very little experience in the field of psychology. So it's not surprising that what we see is not terribly well representative of what goes on in psychotherapy. It's a little bit unfortunate that psychotherapists are also portrayed on television as kind of bumbling, as people who don't have control over their own lives. But I have to admit that, I was a fan of Frasier. I thought it was a well-written television show. Bob Newhart portrayed a psychologist some years ago. Both of these characters were not doing so well in their own lives, well-meaning people. But that's not really what therapy is like. So I found this interview with Dr. Strauss very illuminating. You're going to hear a woman who is clearly very experienced, who has given a great deal of thought to her approach. Listeners to the Psych Files who are therapists will find this very interesting. If you are thinking of becoming a therapist, this will be of interest to you. If you're curious about therapy, maybe you've never been in therapy, you want to know what it's like, what do the therapists say, and do they not say? And I think that's where we reveal a great deal. You know, one of the things they say about music is that it's the spaces, the silences, that give music its character. It's a very similar thing in therapy. When the therapist knows when to be quiet, that reveals a lot about the wisdom and maturity of that therapist. If you are particularly interested in child and adolescent therapy or play therapy, then this will be of interest to you. Okay, let's go.
We are talking with Dr. Martha Strauss, and she's a professor in the Department of Clinical Psychology at Antioch University New England Graduate School, which is not far from where I live, in Keene, New Hampshire. So, Dr. Strauss, just tell us a little bit, if you would, about your background and what took you from there to your book on No Talk Therapy.
Well, thank you very much. I am a parent, and I've been of adolescent and young adult children, and I've been practicing for a lot of years. Got my master's degree first in 1980. So it's been a long journey, mostly focused on children and development. And I started teaching and doing some public speaking, and people would say to me, how do you get children to talk to you? They won't talk to me. I ask them questions about how they feel, and they shrug, and they say fine, and they get mad, and then they don't want to come back. And as I traveled around and was doing supervision and teaching, I was thinking, well, I don't usually have that problem. What is it that I'm doing, and how do I think about it? And the No-Talk Therapy book came in part out of realizing that we have, as a culture, lost our way a little bit about childhood and child development and child therapy, and that I really had some strong feelings about getting us back on the path. The other experience that I want to mention that I think, which is in the preface to that book, is that my dad is now 93 years old and still going strong. But he is a man of very few words, comes from that generation and that character type of really not ever saying very much. And he and I have always been very close because we used to go fishing together. And we would be in this little dinghy on the Long Island Sound, and we would sit quietly for hour upon hour fishing together. And every so often, you know, saying, do you need another worm? Do you want to go fish over there? And looks like you had a nibble. And that would be what we would talk about. And that would be the extent of the conversation. And at the end of the day, we would feel fabulous, close and engaged and hardly having said anything.
It's funny because most people would say that's not a terribly good relationship because there's not enough talking going on.
Yeah, well, that's right. And, you know, as a therapist and someone who is trained in therapy and who comes from a culture where people talk a lot about everything, I think that I understand that. It was quite a shock to me at one point when I realized that not everybody wanted to talk about everything all the time, and that my children would say to me, don't do this to your own kids. Don't practice. You know, I would ask them how they felt. And they would go, you know, you're not supposed to do this to your own kids. And I think I was a little shocked and amazed at some point where I realized not everybody thought talking about things all the time was the greatest, most fun thing to do in the world. We have this very long dependent period where we are growing and changing in really vital ways. And it can't be sped up and it can't be shortened. And the cost of trying to do that is in increasing anxiety among children that I treat, and most people that I speak to concur that we are seeing much more anxious children in the last 15, 20 years. And one reason for that is that the expectations for what they're supposed to do and how they're supposed to be able to process information and express themselves is impossible developmentally. They can't actually do it, and they shouldn't have to. And so therapy stems, the kind of therapy that I think that is effective stems from my belief that when we do child therapy, we need to know something about development and how children problem solve and how children learn to know how they feel and put it into words. I'm not against learning how to do that. I just think the premise often is that when a child comes into therapy of any age, 5, 11, 15, that they should have these skills to answer the question, how did you feel about that? And that even if they have the skills, that is going to be a useful thing for them to do. These are very adult-premised assumptions.
Well, even that expression you just used, you know, how did you feel about that? As a psychology student, one of the first types of therapy that you learn about would be Carl Rogers' approach. That's one of the phrases that you memorize. How did that make you feel? Yeah. Which I guess today Dr. Phil has changed into how is that working for you kind of thing.
Yeah. And the Dr. Phil approach is very upsetting to me also as far as an approach to childhood. I think that the most fundamental question is, will you be there for me when I need you? And the idea of no-talk therapy is premised on secure love. And that's the kinds of interventions and the way we understand how to be with children and who we are to children and how we help families support them is all in pursuit of creating a way of communicating to them so that they really feel that secure love and have the answer to the question, will you be there for me when I need you, answered affirmatively.
Well, it sounds like Eric Erickson would certainly agree with you on that point.
Yeah.
Well, let me tell you a couple of things that that brought me to wanting to talk to you about your approach. Although one thing you reminded me of when you were talking about your teenage daughter is there's a movie that's like a good movie called Freaky Friday. I don't know if you've seen it. Lindsay Lohan is in it.
Yeah, is that the parent switch with the adolescent? Yeah.
I'm not particularly crazy about how the therapist is portrayed through most of it there, but there's a point where the daughter says to the mother, after the mother is using a kind of adult therapy, she says, "Mom, stop therapizing me," I think is the expression. But just after I got my bachelor's degree in psychology, I went to work in a halfway house for adults with psychiatric disorders. And I noticed that the approach that the various people, be they psychiatrists or psychologists or social workers, took with these patients was very much a talking at kind of. I remember one group therapy session in particular where the therapist was trying to explain to this young man who was diagnosed actually with paranoid schizophrenia, in very lectury sort of terms, do you see that? The client nodded and said yes, but I'm off in the corner observing, and I'm just thinking that that's not having any impact on that person. They have learned how to nod their head and say yes and appear to have understood, but the emotion behind what made that person mad in the first place is still there, and this approach was just not working. And then with my own children, I noticed that they don't want to talk. Again, we expect them, if you talk about it, you'll be able to get it out. There's the belief in the catharsis piece there. And then you'll be able to avoid these problems in the future, which, as you point out so well in your book, is you expect the child to have the kind of ability to understand that if I attack a problem now, in the future it won't be. But do children have the cognitive ability to think that far in the future as adults might?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my analogy was, if you have this shot now, you won't get diphtheria someday. And that the shot is what they're focusing on, not the diphtheria, clearly.
Why does this assumption, why does adult-based therapies not work with many children who simply don't want to talk?
There's several reasons for this. One has to do with the whole question of referral, how a child comes into therapy and whose agenda is served by that. In a typical adult therapy with an adult client, the adult client calls the therapist and says, "I want to come in," and comes in and says, "This is what I want to talk about today, and this is what I want to work on," or they focus in on what they perceive as something that would be helpful to share.
Right.
In the child version of this, the adult calls, some children want to come to therapy, but the typical scenario is there's a referral made, and that the problem the child is having is defined and identified by somebody else, teacher, a parent, that sort of thing. And the child is brought in, and the problem definition and agenda is often set by, legitimately concerned adults. But what often happens is there is a recitation of all the ways the child has screwed up in the last week or month or lifetime, and all the ways in which they are causing distress to other people, maybe to themselves also. And then the therapist, somehow we have, in losing our way here a little bit, gets co-opted into being the long arm of the law. So the parent says, "He beat up his little brother again this week." And then you are supposed to say, as a therapist, "Why did you beat up your brother this week? Tell me about what happens. I need to help you learn to control yourself more." And the child may or may not think that that's a key point or an issue to work on. But frequently, the minute you get into that place, you are saying what the agenda is and how the child is screwed up and what you think the problem is. And it's very shameful most kids want you to like them, and just like in adult therapy, we want our therapist to like us and think well of us, see us in a positive light. And children, it's even more so because you're an adult and you have authority and power. So suddenly they're in a place where they have to be defending against somebody thinking that they've really screwed up again. So the first answer to this is just in terms of even the referral. Child therapy is different than adult therapy because of agenda setting. And child therapists have to be sensitive to the shame and embarrassment and lack of defensive structure that a child has so that it comes in. The parent, even as doing no-talk therapy, I still sometimes have this where a parent will say, I've explained how I work with parents, so they're signing on for my approach. But even so, as we're going down the hall, the parent will say, you know, don't forget to tell Dr. Strauss what happened at Uncle Freddy's last weekend. And then I have to bite my tongue because my temptation the second we get into the room would be to say, so what did happen at Uncle Freddy's last weekend? And then we're automatically at the parent's agenda, which can very well be something that just makes the kid feel lousy about himself that he doesn't want to talk about, because who wants to talk about things that make them feel lousy? Most adults don't, so that's the next piece. Children don't actually feel better talking about lousy stuff, and a lot of adults don't, too. Why would you want to go do that? Why would you go pay somebody to talk about how lousy you are?
But many adults will understand, as we mentioned before, that if I talk about this, we'll find a solution and my life will be better sometime in the future.
Yeah, so there is that future orientation, but there's also anxiety management in the present. So that's true. One reason they can't do that is they can't foresee how this work will pay off, but they also can't see how sitting with a stranger asking a lot of nosy questions is supposed to be something that is worthwhile for them to do. They're children. So they lack the cognitive skills, the verbal skills that make them feel competent in an environment where an adult is speaking to them. They also have very little experience. If you think about the way information is typically exchanged with children, it's more like your halfway house example, where people are talking at or to or asking for specific information. There isn't a lot of sustained dialogue with adults in our culture for children. So this is a totally weird, intrusive experience for a lot of kids.
Children in a situation like that, I can imagine this little boy first comes into therapy, and if you start talking about what went wrong at your uncle's house, and as you say, the child is just sitting there thinking, who's this person? And you get the as an observer, you get the sense that the child is just waiting for the 50 minutes to be up, which makes the parent angry because the child's not taking it serious.
Mm-hmm. And that you're a bad therapist because you're not making them do the work and getting them to, quote-unquote, open up. Mm-hmm. And then they feel like bad parents because they have this kid who's in distress and they're doing what they can to get it fixed, and it's not happening. So I'd say it's a lose-lose-lose.
Yeah, and you also feel, you might feel as a parent, you might get angry because it makes so much sense to you that we should just, if we talk about it, we'll be able to get, you know, find a solution. But the child doesn't want to talk about it, which makes you madder as a parent.
Yeah, that's right. And the assumption here is that the child has the capacity but is withholding.
Mm-hmm.
Being resistant, being defiant, and that you as a therapist are being inept, right? Because you can't get them to do it. Did you get them to open up? That's, you know, that kind of thing, kind of question. And kids also identify with their problem set. So as an adult, we have the cognitive capacity to say, even though, I mean, some of us do, I'd say that in crisis we are less able, more regressed, and more like children. But in optimal circumstances, we are able to say, even though I screwed up at that thing, I am not a terrible person. I am just someone who made a mistake, and I can fix this and apologize or whatever. Children don't make that distinction. Adults often say to kids some version of, you're a good person who does bad things.
Or you did a bad thing, but I still love you.
But you did a bad thing, but I still love you. That doesn't mean, you know, you're bad or unlovable.
You hear that so much as being sound advice. Tell the child that while your behavior made me upset or mad or was wrong, you're still a good person. And we think that the child understands that the way that we said that.
Right. And it's still very much worth saying. But when we are talking about problems children have, their experience is we are talking about their fundamental badness. And in answering that question about secure love, what they are feeling is that it is often more conditional. And I think they also sense when we are angry with them or upset about their behavior, and even if we say that, I think they may sense correctly that we actually are pretty furious. So we say, I'm not angry, I'm just worried about you. Or I'm not condemning you, I'm just saying that this behavior is, you know, intolerable. And we say that, but actually a lot of adults who say that are pretty furious and actually withholding secure love at that moment. It's very hard to love a child who just, you know, pounded his little brother into submission. It's hard to feel empathy for the older sibling at that moment. It just is. I'm not criticizing parents for that. I'm just describing that there is often a mixed message in that our words and our interpersonal communication are maybe not one and the same in that. And the child does pick up on it, plus his own shame and guilt about having hurt his little brother is in that example.
Now, you also say that children don't have the emotional maturity to be able even to talk about feelings which might be very mixed.
Right. This is a very, speaking of child development, this feeling vocabulary and how that works is very interesting as kind of a trajectory, what I call developmental runway. It takes a long time developmentally to be able to put all these pieces together, even under optimal circumstances. And when we're talking about children with complicated and chaotic and traumatic environments, this runway is even bumpier. It's harder to take off. But infants have up till about 18 months before there is any narrative going. It's really just pure affect. They feel things. There's no language to mediate it. And, you know, anybody that's had an infant or a toddler in the house knows that they're almost like storm clouds of feelings, you know, big, gigantic, raw affect. And what we expect is that by the time a child is two or three, they may have, you know, the four feeling groups down a little bit, mad, sad, glad, bad.
What were those four again?
Mad, sad, glad, bad.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
The four feeling groups. I mean, people have other variants of that, but that's a nice rhyme. But what we expect is that by the time someone is seven or eight, they would be able to be angry if someone bumps into them when lining up in class, but they wouldn't have to haul off and slug the kid for it because they would be able to be a little better regulated even in the face of stronger feeling and knowledge that made them mad. And by the time someone is in adolescence, we would expect the vocabulary to really become much more textured and nuanced. So from those four feeling groups, we would expect people to begin to language things, bothered, amazed, confused, bewildered, astonished, excited, dismayed, you know, that there would be enriching of vocabulary for internal states. So it's much more complicated. So there's this vocabulary that's supposed to become more precise, but it's more complicated because what you have to be able to do is first to look inside and think, I'm having a feeling, right? So you have to recognize you have a feeling. Then you have to say what it is. You have to name it correctly. And so people get stuck even at that beginning place. If you come from an environment which is complicated and chaotic, or where people don't talk about feelings, or people tell you not to have those feelings or to express them, you end up being very cut off from that. And, you know, a lot of men in our culture have grown up really not knowing. Robert Bly talks about how men look inside, and they can't even recognize they have a feeling. Or if they do, it tends to be anger. That's a feeling they're allowed to express and recognize. But so you have to look inside and say, I know what I'm feeling. It's anger. But that has to also be a correct identification. So what happens for a lot of children who even can do this at all, they say, I am feeling mad or I'm feeling sad. And that may be true, and it may not be true, and it may only be part of what they're feeling. Then they have to give a correct attribution. They have to say, I am feeling mad because he hit me. I am feeling sad because I can't go do this thing that I want to do. And we know well as parents that and adults that people make up stories about how they feel that may or may not be true. I come home at the end of the day. If I've had a bad day at work and I get mad at my child, I may be mad at my child because of their misbehavior, but it's also possible that I'm mad at my child because I'm exhausted and feel unsupported by my partner. Well, you know, there's a lot of other reasons. So we make up a reason. So when you say to a child, how did you feel about that? They have to know they have a feeling. They have to be able to put a word on it that describes it. And they have to be able to understand how it is they feel that way, make up a story about how that could be true. And then we could challenge that too. When you say, how did you feel about that? Sometimes people feel more than one thing. And we know from developmental literature that up until about age 12, it's a must pick one. Kids can't feel more than one way about a thing or no, they do. So they could be having contiguous feelings. I can be excited that I'm going to go see grandma, but frightened about flying on the airplane, but not both. And we know that people feel complicated ways. Children who are abused, for example, have very complex feelings toward their abusive parents. They don't just love them or hate them or fear them or feel blamed or worried. It's all of those things. So when we say, how did you feel about that? What are we asking?
A tough question. I know that for my own child, when one of them lies, I might say, point this out, you know, maybe a lecture follows, but I'll ask, how do you think Daddy feels? And like you just said, it's usually either sad or mad. And I'll say, actually, I feel disappointed. And I'm thinking that she understands that, but there's this blank stare. And in retrospect, I'm thinking, you know, she probably has absolutely no idea what that even means, to be disappointed. It's just too complex of a thing.
Yeah. And she also may perceive that you are saying you feel disappointed. I'm not saying this is so, but I think this is true. A lot of times parents say, I'm worried or I'm disappointed when they're furious. And so children who are sensitive to mixed messages also get confused in terms of other affect coming at them, which is not what they experience it as. So she's experiencing your anger, and you're denying it, and you may or may not be having it, but that's her. So she's having to make, in terms of meaning out of other people's affect, it's the same thing. She's having to process how she feels, what she's getting from you, and what you're saying, and reconcile that contradiction or that distinction.
So if I'm feeling, which I am, feeling a mixture of mad, sad, and disappointed, you know, what is she going to pick out of those things?
Right.
Probably mad, you know, because that's the one that has maybe the worst implications for her. But then I launch into an explanation of how if you lie to me, then I won't be able to trust you, and then other people won't be able to trust you either, and then down the line, and it becomes this thing, which I'm sure they're just sitting out until I'm done, until I've shut my pie hole.
We become those the Peanuts comic strip where the adults off camera going, wah, 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 wah. That's what we sound like to them after a certain point. Because the way that dialogue happens is not only is overwhelming verbally, but my guess, a lot of adults who do, and I think your halfway house example, so shows that adults can do this to adults also, which is there is an affective flooding so that people, once their anxiety arousal level is high enough in a conflict situation, they can't hear anything. You know, once you got your pulse going and your ears ringing and your palms sweating, you're not going to be taking in a lot of information.
All right, good point. Well, before we get to talking about no talk, I just wanted to mention there's some very good points that you make about the other reasons, you know, that we do so much talk in therapy. I think one of them is that we feel as helping professionals that we should be talking, that we should be, that our role is to impart gems of wisdom or to do interventions which are insightful, you know, and that, so I think this is why it's so important for therapists to understand their own needs. You know, what are my needs and what are the patient's needs? And so often I think we act out of our own needs to talk because we feel like that's what we should do. We have all this education and all this knowledge. We should impart it.
Mm-hmm. And when we say play with children, we often use the word just play. Mm-hmm. You know, it's sort of a demeaned version of what it is that real therapy is. Did you just play cards or did you just play Nerf ball with my child? Like that's, you know, it suggests that it's a lesser construct than talk. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the pressure is on. The pressure is on from managed care. The pressure is on from evidence-based treatment directives and, you know, having clear stated attainable goals. The pressure is on from parents. The pressure is on from our supervisors and certainly our own pressure because we don't want to not do anything. We're sitting there thinking, well, what am I doing? Mm-hmm. You know, I have to do something.
Right. I have to
do an intervention.
The big emphasis now, as you mentioned, on the cognitive behavioral, setting goals. I mean, it's so adult focused that, you know, mm-hmm. that we have these goals and we are going to be doing these things and we're going to be talking about this. And then there's the parent who says, you meet with the parent after therapy, right? And you're supposed, it's almost like a little report. Here's what we did. You know, okay. I'm paying this money. Mm-hmm, and as I mentioned once before to you, that as a parent who has sat in on a play therapy session, I must admit I've had this feeling that, geez, here's this adult on the ground playing with my child in a sandbox or, you know, with dolls and, you know, maybe asking what does the giraffe feel about that, but sometimes not, just play, just simple play. Yeah. And I'm thinking, my God, this is costing me so much money. You know, and so to many adults, it just doesn't seem to be accomplishing anything.
So one of the things I do up front is, and even throughout the course of therapy, is really support the parents in their concerns and hopes and dreams for the child so that they're completely on board. And if they have questions about it, what the heck are you doing? The thing I like about the evidence-based movement is that we should be able to have a method to our madness. We should be able to articulate why we believe our interventions are helpful. I mean, I think that is very important, and we certainly have an obligation to parents and to be on the team with parents in helping their children feel and behave better in the world.
Okay, so if you don't mind, we will end part one right there, right before we go into what exactly is no talk therapy. Also, just to let you know, it is early December, and so if you are a student preparing for an upcoming test, don't forget to check out my brain mnemonics PDF that's available on the site, www.thepsychfiles.com. I've got some crazy, wacky images there, which I think will help you remember not only what the parts of the brain are, but what they do. So check that out, and I hope you have a good week. See you next time on The Psych Files.